trauma happens in relationships, and it is in relationships that we have to heal. Hello, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, this is Nishant, and welcome to another episode of the Nishant Garg Show. This show is for people who want to live a life of excellence, love, and joy. And my mission is to bring awareness about transformation, love, and healing. My job on the show is to invite the world-class experts to deconstruct the practices, routines, and habits to help you live a fulfilled and abundant life. Every Friday, I share an exclusive email to all the newsletter subscribers. And this newsletter captures my weekly learnings in the forms of books I'm reading, blogs and articles I'm exploring, recent podcast updates I'm publishing, etc., etc. And you can find the newsletter link at my website, https://nishantgarg.me, nishantgarg.me. And today's guest is Deirdre Fay. Deirdre has decades of experience exploring the intersection of trauma, attachment, yoga, and meditation, teaching a radically positive approach to healing trauma. She has 35 years of experience as a psychotherapist and educator, exploring practical ways of how transformation occurs. Her approach is called a radically positive approach to healing trauma, and her message resonates deeply with those who may look successful on the surface, but internally feel plagued by shame, anxiety, distress, depression, wondering why they are stuck in repeating relational and life patterns. Her third book, Becoming Safely Embodied, became a bestseller. And now, without further ado, please enjoy this wide-ranging conversation with Deirdre. And in this conversation, she invites us to ask, what would ease feel like in our body? So please enjoy this conversation. Deirdre, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for taking your time. We connected in 2021. So finally, we are here. So your name is pronounced as Deirdre, D-E-I-R-D-R-E. So where does this name come from?
It's an Irish name. It's an old, old Irish name. My father was Irish, immigrated to the U.S., and so they always loved that name, and they called me it. You know, but funny thing, Deirdre in Irish mythology is the queen of sorrows. So it's not really the most lighthearted name to be given somebody as they're growing
queen
up.
Queen of sorrows.
The queen of sorrows.
Who gave you this name?
My dad. But, you know, that's just the story of Deirdre of Ireland. And so, but I learned how to integrate my sorrow so that I can actually be free and live a lighthearted, fully joyous life.
Did you ever get a chance to talk to your father that why he gave you this name, which means Queen of Sorrows?
Well, I think he just loved the name, but I hope there wasn't any deeper meaning. I don't think I ever asked him, actually, Nishant. Thank you. I'll have to go into a seance someday and ask him. I never asked him in real life.
Where does he live?
He's passed away at this point. About 10 years now.
Oh, sorry to hear about that. And you live in France now. So tell us about your connection with Ireland, France, and U.S.
Well, let's see. My father and mother had worked for the U.S. government overseas. My dad immigrated, long story. They ended up living all over the world right after the war and met in Berlin, Germany, before the wall was built. And they got married there. And then as a family, we lived in Berlin after the wall. So I've lived all over Europe and traveled all over. My parents were great travelers. And then they lived in Japan, and so I would visit them there and travel a lot to India for yogic practices and training, Ayurvedic training and healing. So that my family just had more of an international experience and way of living. And when I was 18, I decided to go to school in the States instead of staying in Europe. And so I lived in the States, you know, for a long time. I really don't have a story about why we moved to France. There's some logical reasons I could say, but it wasn't that I ever thought of living in France or that I ever thought I'd always been to France many times. You know, I don't know. So anyway, we're here. I think of it as getting my PhD in trust and surrender. You know, it was like, okay, where, to be actually even more honest, it was a lot of work and prayer of where does the universe, if I touch inside and where's my own inner guidance leading us? It was, we tried many places in the US to explore as a place to live. And it was a process of heart braille. You know, we just were like, where are we going? Where are we going? And then it doesn't make any sense whatsoever, Nishan. I can't give you a logical understanding of it. But anyway, we're here in France and loving it. It's perfect for us. Perfect.
It does make sense. So what different places you lived in the U.S.?
Mostly I lived in the Boston area and in New Mexico.
So before we press record, I asked you about your intention for this recording, and you mentioned very beautifully that you want to help people getting unstuck. Could you speak to that, please?
Oh, my goodness. Okay. For years back in the 80s, I lived 80s and 90s, I lived in a yoga ashram and was doing a lot of yoga, a lot of meditation. And it was during that time that my own trauma history came up. And I don't know that I would have said before, probably I was unconscious to it, that I had a trauma history. And there was a very clear demarcation zone of before and after, before my memories came up and after. Before, I was doing a lot of yoga and meditation and training for triathlons, on my bike, swimming, doing two or three exercises a day, to then all of a sudden not wanting to get out of bed. And I was like, what happened to me? What happened? How come I could do this before and now I can't? And so my process from that point on was trying to look at, well, why? If wisdom traditions talk about being in the body is the temple of the soul, I did not feel at all that I was in a temple afterwards. I didn't have the same experience as I did before. And so that led me on this journey. That was my quest. And I'm so grateful that I had the years of meditation and yoga and my Sufi practices to really help me have a different frame of mind, so that when, as my history came up and I started putting the pieces together, I wasn't as stuck in it. And that's really what I want people to share, really, is being with people around that there isn't, we don't have to stay stuck. We don't have to stay trapped in our pain and distress. Even though the pain, the suffering is important, I think of it as our history, our trauma, especially, is a modern day bodhisattva training. That it's really, literally, a chance to learn the step-by-step process of transforming our suffering into compassion. We have to do that in our mind, we have to do it in our heart, and we have to do it in our body.
You mentioned that your trauma history erupted. I want to discuss more about that, but before that, I would love for us to discuss more about your yoga ashram visit in India. So how did you end up going to India in the 80s and 90s? What events were leading up to that incident?
Well, it wasn't just in India. I was mostly in the Massachusetts area, in the Berkshires of Massachusetts, and ashram there. And I had been in an advertising agency before. And this is what I've come to believe, is that life, when we're trying to align ourselves with union, with God, Goddess, Muhammad, Jesus, Buddha, whatever frame of reference you have, when we want to align with that, life will, if we get off track, life will say, okay, we got to reorient you. I'm going to pick you up and move you here. And that's happened to me multiple times. And that happened. I was in working for an advertising agency, and I was always a seeker. And then I wanted, how do you say what happens? You know, it's like there was something in the ashram that was about dedicating my life to love. And I wanted to learn how to live and love unconditionally, even though I had no idea how to do that. That was the calling. You know, we think of that in all the transformational and all the wisdom traditions. There's a call. That was my call. But who, you know, there's no training for how do you love unconditionally. And I certainly have not learned. I'm in, you know, a very beginning stage of that. But it's really important to me. How do I clear my stuff, whatever keeps me separate from love, so that I can be as loving as I possibly can? So that's the call. And then there's the living of it. So that's what brought me to an ashram. And then in the ashram, my trauma history came up. And then it was like, well, how do I, okay, now that my stuff, I feel wounded and I felt victimized by life as I got in touch with that, how do I shift that? How do I return to that state, you know, or how do I deepen into that state that I had touched before? That was the process.
I'm curious to ask you, what happened in the ashram that brought your trauma history, and how did you recognize that what's happening to you is trauma? Because people may not even know that they are triggered, that trauma is happening. So how did you recognize that something is happening with you? What caused in you at that time?
Oh, such a profound question. And I don't have a clear answer, Nishant. So let me sit with that for a moment. I think the beautiful thing about yoga and meditation, any of the practices, the wisdom tradition practices, is it clears our stuff. You know, our stuff comes up, and then we're meant to clear it. That's what mindfulness is all about. The Vipassana is about rising up of our unconscious material and clearing it, and being able to watch and witness it come. Well, at some point when you're doing that, you're going to clear and you're going to clear and you're going to clear, and then poof, it's going to be there. And it will come multiple ways. It might come through a workshop. It might come through losing all your money. It might come from a love relationship falling apart. It might come from, I don't know. There's multiple ways, multiple doorways in. And it cracks us open. And it's kind of like those Russian dolls that are nested inside each other. You know, we think, oh, that's who I am. And then clonk, no. And we think that's who we are. And there's no. And it's that clearing process to get to more and more our heart. And I remember I used to swim at a Christian monastery nearby.
And in India?
This was in the States. This is in Massachusetts. And I can't remember something. I was feeling hurt for some reason. I don't even remember the situation. I remember going after swimming. I went into their little chapel on the grounds, and I was the only one in there. And I was just praying, and I had this spiritual experience of some kind where it was about Mother Mary. This was a chapel to Mother Mary, and however the information came in, Mother Mary said to me, don't think this is all you are. You are being cracked open so you can find a bigger heart, more of you. Now, that all sounds so good, but we all hate it when we're in it. It's awful. But there was that holding of it, like, oh, okay, the cosmology of it is you can get through this. You're being opened up for something else. And I don't even know, how did we get here, Nikishan? You asked me a question, and I'm going down this telling the story I don't usually tell people.
We are going the right path. Please continue.
So I have come to trust love. And I think in many ways our life is learning to get a master's and PhD in love. And we have to learn how to trust and surrender along the way. and it's very, very hard. But I think that life is deliberately about letting us know that we're so much more than our pain and misery and our distress and our disappointments. And we need to have a larger community around the witness. We need to, I believe that, we need a larger community. We need people to be saying, it's okay to be in pain, because that's not all you are.
Earlier in this conversation, you said that aligning life with God, Muhammad, Jesus, if I heard correctly. So what do you mean by aligning life? And if someone listening to this podcast saying that, and how do I do this if I have a desire and longing to align my life with love in God? How do I do this?
Oh my goodness. We have a whole coaching program around just this, which is how do you trust your own reason for being, your life purpose? Align with that, attune to what that is, and then begin to amplify that in the world. How do you be connected inside? And not just to the personality, not just to who I am presenting into the world, but what is my real heart about? What have my wounds cracked me open to be so that I can contribute to the world in a much larger way, to be of service, to practice seva, however that is, to serve the world. And in return, I'm served. And so what we find in our community is that the people who are drawn to it are mostly professionals, helping professionals, many of them, that want to clear their stuff, whatever that is, so that they can be of greater service to the world.
You have mentioned stuff a couple of times. Could you elaborate more on what stuff is? What do you mean by that?
It's the polite term of S apostrophe, 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 whatever that is. Ampersand, or whatever that little star thing.
You are allowed to use any word here.
Well, it's our shit, you know, the stuff that comes up. So if I think, oh, I'm not loved, or I'm not wanted, or I have nothing to offer, or I'm unworthy, or I'm nobody's there, nobody's helping me, whatever it is. And this is where attachment theory I found extremely helpful. I remember I was in a workshop with who became my mentor, Daniel Brown. And during that, I walked in and he started talking. I was like, all the pieces came together, all my trauma studies and understanding and work, clinical work, it all came to bear. The reason we don't do well in our lives is because we didn't have certain, what I think of as the 7 fundamental attachment needs that help us feel solid, steady, and secure inside, to have an unshakable heart. So the problem is that these attachment relationships are embedded really early, before we have a real narrative understanding of our life. They're embedded between the years of birth and 3 years. But they're embedded in our body. They're embedded in a way of our how we perceive the world. It's like how we, the air that we breathe, the water we swim in, it's so normal and so the way it's supposed to be that we don't think it can be anything different. And that then forms what I call like the contact lenses of our life. They're what we look out of the world on. John Bowlby, who's the grandfather of attachment theory, called it the internal working model. And that internal working model is the template out of which we live. And we have the research, you know, so much research backing this up, that those internal working models, if they're not changed or interrupted over time, will actually, the pattern that we were embedded with in those early years will be replicated throughout our life 77% of the time, unless we intervene in it. It was mind-bendingly amazing to me to stumble on this. I thought, this is our stuff. This is our shit. This is what gets in the way. These really simple, simple things. And it shows up that the model that I've created is, I call it a transformational model. And this is all from attachment theory and from integrating yogic and Buddhist psychology. some Sufi practices as well. But we are protesting. And how many times a day do we all say, oh, it shouldn't be like this. I hate this. This isn't right. It should be different. We all have multiple times a day when we're upset at something. And if we start looking at those little multiple times and the big ones where we're quote unquote triggered, right, there's a protest. There's something inside of us saying this isn't right. We're having a temper tantrum of some kind. Well, if we look at that, what inside of us knows that it should be different? If it's supposed to be this way, we wouldn't be upset. It would just be the way it's supposed to be. But we're upset, right? Isn't that true, Nisha? We're upset because something deep inside of us says it should be different. This is fundamental. And it's when we wrap our head around it, it's like, this is the key to unlock our lives. It's like we're saying, oh, you shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't have said that. You shouldn't have hurt me. I should be, whatever it is. Why? That's because it's our inner knowing, our wisdom, trying to point us in a new direction. But what do we all do? I mean, let's all raise our hands. We know this so well. We're in that protest and we're spinning like crazy. We're so upset and it's so captivating. We're entranced and bewitched by this protest. And we get stuck. And when somebody says, no, it doesn't have to be that way, we're like angry at the somebody for trying to get us to change. Because what's understandable is we want to be heard, right? We want our upset to be heard. But if we're so entrenched in our upset, we're never going to see what that upset is wanting us to know something else. So the protest is this really important first phase. But out of that protest, a need arises. There's a need there. The reason why we're protesting is there's this underlying need. Well, what is it? And I think of it as these seven fundamental attachment needs. We need to belong and feel safe and secure. We need to be attuned to. We need to be reassured and have a body sense of calmness and learn how to regulate and have affect regulation. Simple things we need. We need to know that we're special and wonderful. And there's this idea of an attachment theory of expressed delight. Somebody saying, oh my God, you're so amazing. Look at what you do. You know, I'm such a beginner painter, like really beginner. But when I show my paintings to my husband, he's like, oh my God, that's so beautiful. And now, isn't that what we all want? We see it with kids. A kid brings you a little stick that they found on the street. And you're like, what the heck? What's that stick for? No, you say, oh my God, what an amazing stick. I don't think I've ever seen such a beautiful stick. And that little kid or us as adults, we open up like a flower. Somebody sees us and gets us in the most beautiful way. And it's a huge need we all have. We have needs for knowing that we can have conflict and we can repair that conflict, that the relationships will actually get stronger, better, more solid out of conflict. But nobody teaches us about how to deal with conflict. We need to know how to not take life personally. You know, so these are fundamental attachment needs that we all have. And I mean that in they're fundamental non-conscious needs.
It's so as an adult, how we can learn these seven fundamental needs? So first thing is, I think, knowing the definitions. What are they and what practices we can adopt? Could you walk us through the definitions in brief about all these seven attachment needs? Or internal working models, as you say, and as an adult, how can we have those needs met in our life?
That's so great. Well, one of the key things is actually knowing that they're there. So for many people, just beginning to name or protest as protest is key. I'm upset. I can't find my keys. I'm upset. Well, what is that upset about? Let's just slow down and pause and be with that. I feel out of control. Okay. So I feel out of control. There's this expectation I should be in control. Well, let's take a little moment and see, where did you learn that being in control is the way to be and that you can't just slow down and start looking around and see what else is there? Because we know when we're upset, our perceptual vision closes and we only see what we're really freaked out about. So learning to calm down, let the nervous system, the body, and the mind relax actually opens up our field of vision. But so when somebody's in that, it's like walking down into that, well, what is it you need? What is it you need? What is it you need? And letting them come to whatever it might be. And it's usually in this realm of any one of these. Well, if I was in control, then somebody would have loved me more. Somebody wouldn't have humiliated me, or somebody wouldn't, whatever it might be. There'll be some wound that's at the basis of that. And that wound is, I would have rather somebody had loved me or reassured me, like, it's okay. It's okay. We have another key here. You don't need to worry about that. It's like, oh, what does that do? That gives you, somebody sees me that I'm upset. Somebody hears me, validates my concern, and then reassures me and soothes me. So maybe you never had somebody help you learn how to soothe yourself. Well, once you get that, once you know the genesis of that, the origin story of that need, it's like, okay, what's it like to actually let your body fill with that longing for that? And this is what's most complicated for people, because we've trained ourselves not to feel, or when we get close to those needs, to bump up and get away from our, you know, it's like, ah, that's the last thing I want to feel is that. And so we run away. But what if we're actually and drop into that and let my body feel it? What if I let my skin literally fill up with that longing to be reassured or soothed or comforted or seen or not, whatever it might be? Learning how to let that come up. And then what tends to happen is that there comes what I call a nourishing opposite. Out of the protest is the need. The need is pointing to something. Let's say you're in a relationship and you're not heard and loved in the way that you want. Okay. So you start paying attention. You realize, oh, I really want to be loved. So that's the nourishing opposite. I'm not loved, but I want to be loved. Okay. That's the nourishing opposite. Well, let's make that granular and specific. Look here. We all want to be loved. But in you, in each person, it's going to be different. Love, I want to hear something. I want to see something. I want to feel something. I want to taste something. What is it? Let's get really curiously granular around it. Like when somebody loves you, what are their eyes communicating? What are their voice communicating? How is their holding their body? And then what are the inner signals? Like, how does that link up with you inside? So you're gonna hear that sound and what happens in your body. And as you do that, you literally start training your body to have that experience instead of the old internal working model. So that's how we operationalize the protest into a new experience. But it's literally a training, minute by minute, granular moments of what we want, the experience we want to have inside.
Do you feel that sometimes we have worked on all these needs, we have understood the attachment theories, but at times our old wounded self, the egoic mind, comes into play and we start to feel unworthy, we are not good enough. There are times we feel that we have done the work, everything is good, but another time the old self, wounded self, or not so good self starts to kick in. Then how do we uncover that? And the reason I'm asking you is that this unworthiness theme is coming up to me this week, and I'm reading and studying about it, and then I tell myself, I matter, I'm lovable, I'm this and that. So what would you say, and what would you suggest to the people who are listening if they are in my shoes?
Yeah, I totally get it. And that's where I like this idea. For me, it's been helpful to have this idea of a modern day bodhisattva training, that it's not like a clear path.
Bodhisattva, right?
Bodhisattva is somebody who is choosing to stay in this lifetime and help others transform their suffering into compassion. But I think that's what we're all called to. We're all called to like be in our shit and say, okay, okay, I'm unworthy. So there's a researcher named John Gottman who talks about these, we have perpetual problems. And we can think about it, the unworthiness may be the karmic seed of your life. It may just be something that you're always going to be like, oh, here it is. Oh my God, there's my unworthiness pattern coming up. Okay. But rather than being stuck in it, we begin to name it and see how it's showing up and almost like bless it, because it's a guru coming to you to say, oh, this is not quite right. So if I'm that, if that's my protest is, oh, here I am unworthy again. What do I need? I want to feel worthy, but what is it that my body, my heart, my soul needs right now? I need to be loved. I need to be cared about. I need to make $1 million, whatever it is. It's like, okay, how do I, okay, that's what I need. Now I make it granular. What would love look like very specifically? What would it look like out there? What would it feel like in here? I want $1 million. Okay, what would $1 million create in my outside world? What would that look like out there? And then how can I feel it inside? And very specifically, when I, well, I've done this multiple times in my own life, but I think of recently, the last time I was in India, actually, I was on an Ayurvedic retreat and my hip started hurting and I didn't know what it was. And then I was teaching in Ireland and it was hurting all the time and it kept getting worse and worse. It took 2 or 3 years. And the doctor said, well, you have arthritis. And I thought, I can't have arthritis. Too young. It shouldn't be. There was my protest. It shouldn't be. I shouldn't have arthritis. And so one of the ways I worked with it is I would lay in bed and I'd be like, okay, what would ease feel like in my body? And that's part of a larger pattern of ease. What would ease? Okay, I don't know. How do I have ease in my body? How do I have ease in my body? What it really get in my hip? How would my hip know it was at ease? And this isn't something that you can figure out with your mind. It's sensing into your body and, like I said, brailing your way around. Anyway, I ended up having surgery when I came to France and had that fixed. But the other thing is, by training my body about what ease was, that was one of the things that led us to France. I am so at ease and so content here in France. It's unbelievable. Like I've never known before.
How do we train our body to feel ease?
I know. Let's think about it. Well, let's take, do you mind if I use your example?
Please.
Unworthiness. So how do you know you feel unworthy inside yourself? Do you have thoughts? Do you have feelings? What's going on?
It's a thought. It's a question. I feel cognitively and I'm good at processing that cognitively. And then I journal and then I see that from where it is coming from. I know that this is coming from the childhood. I work through it, but at times it comes, but the intensity is not high of it. I can navigate through it because I've done some work, but the intensity is not very high. It does not immobilize me. It does not make me feel stuck in life. I have friends. I have a support system I can go to if something is really bothering me, I have this monkey mind chattering that when that does not stop, and then I try to focus on my breathing and then go for long walks and try to get into my body. That helps me.
So let's look at it a different way then. What would be more nourishing than feeling unworthy?
I think just the human touch, human connection. And that was a very lacking factor in my childhood. That's what I long for. That's what I desire for. And my recent learning is shifting my longing to desire, because when I'm longing, it feels distant. It feels very distant. And when it is very distant, or when something is very distant, it feels hopelessness about the future. So I'm practicing shifting my longings to desire, because when I have a desire, I'm hopeful.
Well, let's exactly. And you can see there's the longing for human connection, and then there's the old memory. Your body knows that human connection is distant and then rolls into hopelessness and feelings like that. But let's look at, well, what is human connection? Human connection, what's a small way you know about human connection?
What is human connection?
Like, how would you know if somebody out there, some human out there, was connecting to you in a way that you wanted?
The automatic response that comes to mind is when they see you, when they see into your eyes, when you smile to them, they smile back to you. When you have a healthy, loving conversation, you can't have a loving conversation with a stranger, but you can have a healthy conversation. Your body knows. I know in my body when I feel that. I feel high vibrationally aligned. I know when I'm there. I know when I'm not feeling vibrationally high. When I'm not feeling vibrationally high, I'm feeling small. So, and before we go further, I want to say that I don't want to make this a personal coaching session in this recording.
Oh, I totally get it. Well, we don't have to go there, but you see how it is. If I was working with myself, I'd be like, okay, human connection is when I see somebody sees into my eyes. Okay, so what is it I'm seeing in their eyes that then has me feel that vibrational alignment? And there's this idea in attachment theory, Kohut talked about it, about the light in the mother's eye, how the mother's eyes would just light up around the child. That's something like an experiment might be, okay, that person, when their eyes light up when they see me. So then I'd spend some time. This is just me. This is what I would do, right? I'd be like, okay, so imagine that person's eyes lighting up. Actually, this is how I found my husband, because I had been in a long relationship for 16 years. That was not maybe the healthiest relationship, but it was certainly what I knew from my lifetime, my history. And when that relationship, well, during many years, about 10 years of that, I was training myself to have a different relationship. Because everything that kept the protest over and over was, this isn't right, this isn't right. Something's not right. And I trained myself to begin seeing what it was. And one of the things...
I have a question for you here. What did you train on? I'm curious too.
Exactly. In fact, some of this comes from my training with the Sufis, is learning to clear the veils. You know, they talk about the 99,000 veils between you and God. So I'd be like, okay, so the protest comes up. Obviously, and certainly in non-dual traditions, we think there's no separation. We believe that we're all a union, like I'm already connected to all that is. Okay. But if I'm not feeling loved, I'm disconnected from that. So how do I reconnect? Okay. Well, one small way would be if that person looked at me and they saw the best in me instead of the worst in me. Well, I have no idea what that would be like if somebody saw the best in me. So this would be my meditation practice. I'd be like, okay, so how would I know that somebody looked at me that would mean inside me that they see the best in me? And I just played with a million thousand things, and then I get more and more and more specific. What would that look like? What would that feel like? And as I did, I met this amazing, that was just one of many doorways into how I met my husband, but this amazing human being who sees the best in I can't do anything. I mean, he's amazing. And I feel amazing around him. Like, I feel so loved. I never knew what that was like.
Could you tell us what other doors he knocked to get your husband?
Well, it was certainly, I remember very much around somebody seeing the best in me. It was also around, gosh, I'm trying to remember. I remember just feeling safe, like really safe. What was it like to be connected? I didn't know what it was like. The man I was with before, it was just not, I never really felt connected. I always felt like there was always something wrong with me, and it was like I could never do it right. And so I worked those small little doorways. Each of those little protests, I would be like, okay, so I don't want this. What do I want? And then, okay, I want that. So how do I feel that in my body? Like the same thing with ease. What is ease? I don't know what ease is. What would it be like to be at ease around another human being? What would it be like to feel like your whole viscera relaxing? What would it be like to have your eyes not always monitoring? Then you say, okay, well, my eyes need to relax in my eye sockets. What is that like to have my eyes relax in my eye sockets? And that's the meditation. You relax your eyes and you train your body to have relaxed eye sockets. You train your body to let your viscera, the diaphragm, release. You know, and that might take, you know, a steady practice. Standing at the supermarket, check out, and you're like, okay, just, what would that be like? What would that be like? And you train your body.
Could you suggest blogs, books, resources, anything that we can read or listen to or watch to get more hang of all these embodiment practices?
My next book, Nishant, I don't know anybody. This is all what I learned from putting piece by piece together. I don't say that in any other way to say I don't know anybody who's doing that.
Your next
Everybody,
book?
My next book, yeah. Yeah.
What is your, if you could tell us about your current present book? We haven't talked about it.
I have two other books that I've written. One, the last book is the Becoming Safely Embodied. And the book before that is Attachment-Based Yoga and Meditation for Trauma. And then I co-wrote a book with my mentor, Dan Brown, and David Elliott, and a small group of us that worked together for about 11 years or 13 years over time, just weekly. That's an amazing book. It's called Attachment Disturbances in Adults.
So let's talk about your book, Becoming Safely Embodied, and that's how we got connected. How can someone benefit and learn from this book?
Well, one of the things that people get from it that has been so helpful is being able to dial down things to small increments. You know, I talk about making things granular, but most people don't know how to do that. We're used to thinking fast and moving over something instead of thinking slow. Like Daniel Kahneman talks about going really, really slow and sensing into the body instead of thinking my way into the body. And so there's a way to break it apart. It's like even what I learned in, like I knew about mindfulness, but to really practice mindfulness, what's a thought? What's a feeling? What's a body sensation? If I say to you, well, what would, to be vibrationally aligned? Okay, that's a concept in our head, but what would that feel like? If I was to sense into my body, well, first, what most people come up are lots of thoughts about it, theory, stories, memories, associations. But if you sense into that felt experience, and Eugene Genlin taught us a lot about that in focusing, how do you sense into that? And just stay there and be with that and let that move. So that's one of the main things. There's also a lot in Becoming Safely Embodied about undoing your triggers and deconstructing them so that you can shift them and change them. And there's some really simple but fun ways to practice having a different experience of your life, a different story of your life. One of the powerful things people learn is about this idea of parallel lives, which is we're here in the current year of 2022, but sometimes our reactivity, let me just say, our reactivity is about stuff that's unconscious or held and stored in our body. So how do we stay in 2022 and recognize, oh my gosh, part of the reason why I'm so activated is because it's my old stuff coming up. And then how do I be in touch and care for what's going on inside myself?
And I would love to get your perspective on my own experience at times, that sometimes in doing this inner work, the mind goes back too far in the past, that I remind myself to come back into my body through different practices. So are there good ways to remind ourselves that we are in the present moment? There happens a cognitive dissonance, right?
Right.
So how do we do it more actively if we are having these narrations, these old stories running into our mind, like we are somewhere in the past or in the future, right?
Well, there's one of the practices, the skills I teach is about facts versus feelings. How, and we know this in meditation, mindfulness, Vipassana is about bare noticing, bring it down to the very small things. Like I'm talking, you're nodding, I'm talking. Very simple. Well, when we're triggered and activated, all those storylines are going on. Sometimes we get hooked by it. We get caught in it. And so what is the fact? If we break it down to the smallest common denominator, we unhook the associations and the storyline and the narrative from it, and we create a pause moment. Is this small enough that we can say, okay, let me just stay here and be with this? And then we can start adding in the different feelings about it so that we can integrate and process it more. I learned this a lot from a woman named Yvonne Agazarian, who is no longer here, unfortunately, but she did a lot of work around system-centered living and system-centered theory. And one of her skills was breaking this down into small bits so that you could, so longer, so more theoretical, so you could rework the tiny bits of it.
Could you give us a small example about the fact versus feelings? What could be the fact?
The fact is, I'm talking. The fact is, I'm talking. The fact is, I'm talking. The fact is, your eyes moved. The fact is, nothing's happening. But then once your body is more regulated, we talk about the window of tolerance. Once your body is in the window of tolerance, you can then say, okay, the feeling I have is, oh my God, I don't know. Nobody's listening. I live in a vacuum. This is one of my clients I work with recently. When there's dead silence or she's not hearing comments back right away, she goes into a vacuum state, which was an old repetition of her growing up. It's like, but that's not what's happening. The fact is, she said something, I was listening, and I didn't speak right away. Those are the facts. The storyline, the narrative is, oh my God, you don't really care about me. You think I'm stupid. But it's not true.
Then I have your book in front of me right now, Becoming Safely Embodied. And I don't read book from page one to page N. I read whatever I need. So I started reading your book from skill number 9, finding guidance from your older, wiser self. And I wrote a blog post on that, how my older self would talk to me. I journal on this. So could you give us a brief intro about how do we invite our older, wiser self to have this interaction with our present self in our tough times, in our good times?
I think we should be listening to you, Nishant. If you wrote a blog post about it, well, you should post that so we all can see it. Let me know so I can send it around to everybody.
I write deep shit.
Oh, like that. Deep shit is good. It's very simple. You know, we know this from athletic training, peak performance training. is athletes who are working at a very high level are not just they're using their imagination to create experience. So we can do that just as well. So if I'm X age, is the okay, so if I'm 90 or 80, what would that 80-year-old, how did that 80-year-old get to be a better place? And what wisdom can that 80-year-old tell me so that I can actually make that happen? And people come up with surprisingly beautiful things. Like, I can't wait to read what you came up with.
Thank you for your time. Thank you so much for everything you have shared with us. I know you have to run very soon. So anything else we could have shared and didn't get a chance to discuss?
Holly, that you are a heart of gold. I see I feel it, and I'm just thrilled and delighted to have this time with you.
Thank you so much. I receive it. And I want to send your love and blessings to all the listeners through me.
For sure.
Last but not the least, where people can find more about you.
My website is dfay.com. My Instagram is, my handle is dfaypics, dfaypics, if I just spell it in my head. And my Facebook page is Healing Attachment.
Awesome. We will put everything in the show notes, and we are all set. So thank you so much again.
Lots of love and blessings to you and to everybody.
Thank you for listening to this podcast episode today. If you did enjoy this, please subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, or you can visit https://nishantgarg.me. nishantgarg.me. You can also share this episode with your loved ones to help them live a fulfilled life. You are not alone in this journey. We all struggle in life. There is no shame in talking about it. I go through my highs and lows. I get depressed, and these practices help me in living a resilient life. You can also do this. You got this. Don't judge yourself. You are doing the best you can. And thank you so much again.